My guest tonight is Joe Atwell. He returns to the show. Joe, how are you doing?
Good. How are you, Timothy?
Very well. Listen, Joe, thank you for coming back on the show. Joe is a researcher and independent scholar. He's the author of Shakespeare's Secret Messiah and Caesar's Messiah, the Roman Conspiracy to Invent Jesus. His website is postliviana.org. Joe also co-hosts The Secret Society Revealed, a weekly podcast that is carried on the Revolution Radio Network. That's on Friday now, isn't it?
Friday, yes, at 9 o'clock Pacific Standard Time.
Oh, great. Yeah, okay. And, Joe, you've done some recent podcasts where you've tied Alfred Kinsey to Aleister Crowley, the Rockefellers, the American Jewish Committee, and to MK Ultra. Through these connections, I think you've identified the various groups or factions that comprise what Ken Kesey called the Combine.
Yes, indeed. That was the purpose of the research, and that's what I attempted to do, was to determine the identity of the secret society that has slithered into control over our political, financial, and media worlds.
Now, through these groups, through these secret societies, these networks, clandestine networks, very powerful, very wealthy, influential. They control the media. They control the pretty much control the economy through the banks, central banks. They can engage in high-level criminality in what is best described as organized malevolence. Let's get into this. Alfred Kinsey, this sort of this academic weirdo, I guess.
Right.
I mean, somehow became a cult figure. How did this happen?
Yeah, I mean, Kinsey is a crackpot in terms of his science. It's almost painful to talk about Kinsey as an individual because he's so neurotic. He had a fixation of putting instruments up his penis. Some of them ended up being too gruesome to talk about. He did this because he claimed he had homosexual fantasies and he wanted to punish himself. His methodology is simply preposterous. I mean, he would, among other things, collect the sex diaries of pedophiles. And then he would try to organize the pedophile sex diaries into data. And then from there, go out and draw conclusions. Had all kinds of methodology, which has never really been disclosed. I mean, no one really knows exactly how the hard data that he was basing his claims upon, was organized. He ended up with very high fractions of the population as having homosexual or marital infidelity, various what could be seen at that time as sexual perversion. So he saw this very high fraction of the population. Later researchers couldn't replicate his data. And of course, the way it was organized was just absurd. So the question is, well, how did he become sort of like an icon? And there was really two ways. One, the media picked him up. The media just used him as though he was, basically the Thomas Guide of human life experience. You know, they just produced all of this, his information and media components as the truth. They didn't really put him under any kind of scrutiny. And then magazines like Playboy magazine would reference him whenever there was someone was challenging what they were doing as being culturally debasement. They would say, well, you just don't know, the degree of the population that actually has these feelings and how normal they are. And so Kinsey was very much a component of the debasement of culture. In other words, if you look at where we are now, right, you have the pornography, you have family production at extremely low levels. You have out of wedlock births basically just through the roofs. So how did we get here? How did you come from the 1950s, and turn all of these longstanding statistical bulwarks of culture and civilization on their head and end up where we are today with what can be described as basically a degenerate and pornographic culture. Well, it was, you know, the media's the one of the reasons, one of the ways we got there was through this use of Kinsey's science. Kinsey was also promoted by the political class. FDR gave him his own basically attorney, and this was a close confidant of FDR, who was actually very, very powerful. And I can't recall it right now. I believe it was Wallace, but this individual,
was it Wechsler?
Pardon me?
Wechsler.
Wechsler. Thank you. Yeah, it was Wechsler. So Wechsler promoted legislation that would support this new reality of our sexual nature that Kinsey had brought to our attention. And so Wechsler had a two-prong attack. One, he just actually created legislation, model legislation, and then sent it out to the state legislatures to change the state's sexual mores and laws. But he also started the process by changing the nature of law schools so that instead of teaching basically how to enforce the law and how to prosecute criminality as the focus of law school, they changed and became basically advocacy training, right? So that lawyers would then know how to sue the states and local communities to affect, you know, FDR's vision of, you know, different kind of social programs and this new morality that they wanted to hoist on the American people. And so what happens then is that the sovereignty of the individual sovereigns, in other words, you have, you know, the towns, the cities, the counties, and the states, which under the original Constitution, the old one, before we had the, you know, the modern version that we have to deal with now, these areas had they had sovereignty. They could make their own sexual mores. They could make their own legislation, you know, and have regulations against homosexuality, pedophilia, you know, things like this. And so that was basically taken away, and the federal law then trumped the small sovereignties. And it really stems from Wechsler, who worked with FDR to bring this about, to make this change. And so one of the things that really manifested from the change was the change in the laws regulating sexual morality. And basically the small sovereigns all lost the capacity to regulate it. And so then you end up with, in the 60s, you have another phase of the attack against American culture took place with, beginning with Gordon Wasson, with his participation in MK Ultra to bring about the psychedelic revolution. This was, of course, you know, a government project. It was to go basically, you know, hand in glove with the new laws. The laws would permit, you know, sexual exploration, and the media would promote these new lifestyles. You know, you have Woodstock, where basically rock and roll, drugs, and sex out of wedlock, obviously, are all just, you know, forced into the minds of all the young people. And so, you know, this conjunction of these programs had the effect that was desired, and you started to have the family disintegrate. And so now, if you look at, you know, family production in the United States, you'll see that it's at historically low levels, and it is headed straight down, you know, basically all throughout the second half of the 20th century and to where we are today. And then, and Tim, if you bear in mind that culture is never static, it's always going someplace, I think if you look at where we were in 1950, 56 and then see where we are in 2016, you can see we've made a long trajectory, long pathway. But imagine where we'll be in another 50 years. And I think the latest meme is pedophilia. I can see that pedophilia is now being normalized. There's slowly a kind of breaking down of the moral resistance to it. And I do think that it's where one of the things that you'll see in the future is that the laws around pedophilia will start to break down. So, all of this ends up, of course, with genocide and then extinction because, now the Europeans are not at replicant rate. We're not even close. I was listening to a podcast the other day about Europe and England's birth rates, the native populations, and they're just collapsing. There really won't be any European population in 100 years at the current trends continue. And you have to remember that we were told that there was a population bomb and that there was a baby boomer. Notice the psychological negative terms that are used against that trying to tell people that there is overpopulation. Well, obviously, if you look at the Rockefeller and Roosevelt participation in this, you can see that the oligarchs have always wanted to reduce the European population. And then, of course, this was after World War I and World War II, which were, even though they're famous, at least World War II is very famous as, the Holocaust of the Jewish captives. In fact, it was the whole century was a Holocaust of the European. One of my research projects is trying to find out how many Europeans died in the 20th century from war and related events. And, you can't even get within 20 million of the correct number of because it's somewhere between, the top end would be like 250 million and maybe the bottom end is 180 million. But it's just incredible that there isn't, a rounding error is 10 million people. I mean, this is how catastrophic the century was. And so, when I, look at the malfeasance that you can clearly see operating against, what can be called European culture, my question is like, were the world wars just part of this project, there is pretty good evidence, rises to a very high level of suspicion that the wars were just faked. And that what happened was, the secret society had determined, that they wanted to reduce European populations. And so they just, using their control over the political class, ran the armies into one another and, held them there and, just slaughtered them. So, we're dealing with very grim facts and conjecture. Citizens need to be alert. Citizens need to spend more time trying to research their history and also just need to be alert to the fact that there's malfeasance in the government.
Now, yes, talked about Alfred Kinsey at the start here, and yeah. he is known as one of the fathers of the sexual revolution because he published these books that had an academic veneer to them, the Sexual Behavior in the Human Male, that was, I think, 1948. Yeah. 5 years later, Sexual Behavior in the Human Female. Yeah. Of course, the methodology has long since been, justifiably dismissed.
Yeah, it's a crackpot, yeah.
Nevertheless, he receives all the support of officialdom and the establishment. He becomes this cult figure. As you said, he's cited by Playboy magazine, another probably intelligence-linked magazine, because they, I think, just on coincidence, Hugh Hefner acquired the nude photographs of Marilyn Monroe just when she was becoming a star, which put Playboy on the map.
Yeah, I've never bought the Playboy story. I don't have any, you know, evidence, but I've never bought it. And the more I look at that part of history in a general sense, the more certain I am that that whole thing was just an op. And I'll reference the fact that, you know, one of the trademarks of the oligarchs is to see Europeans as animals. That's one of the ways they characterize, you know, like you see Walt Disney with his Mouseketeers, you know, and Shakespeare, you know, referring to them as pigs. And then, of course, Hugh Hefner has the bunny. But I think that that fits into basically what can be called neuro-linguistic programming. And it's just a way to present images to the culture of women in a debased and animal state that are positive. You know, it's a very cool thing to be a bunny. The CIA agent, Gloria Steinem, she was photographed, you know, in a bunny outfit. Mm-hmm. You know, this is supposed to be a feminist. So, you know, that's how I would look at Playboy, is just clearly, you know, it's hard to imagine it was circumstantial. And I would think it just needs a little scrutiny. Some research need to go in and just pin down Hefner's connections into, you know, basically the government operation against our culture.
Sure. And now Kinsey, of course, his research, as you alluded to or mentioned earlier, it involved, you know, supposedly getting the data from pedophiles and their, and I guess
sex diaries, yeah,
sex diaries, because that's a crime. That's evidence of a crime. Yeah. And there's some evidence that he paid these people for their behavior, correct?
Right. I know, which is just absolutely insane. But I think, you know, the really interesting character that Kinsey is connected to is Aleister Crowley.
Yeah.
And there is actual primary documentation, real citations, people who were there in the room wrote about it, that Kinsey attempted to buy Aleister Crowley's sex diaries, and in fact may have. And, you know, they don't have that as a data that I've ever been able to find a citation about, but those that were there are certain that Kinsey was attempting to get Crowley's diary because he knew Crowley was a pedophile. And he wanted to see, you know, and I don't, you know, it's like to go into some of these details is almost too disgusting, you know, for people to discuss. But it's, I mean, you know, Kinsey would attempt to characterize the orgasms or sexual response of the child participant, which included trying to strike the adult who was raping them, in essence.
It's called self-defense.
And these were characterized as attributes of the child orgasm, right? Because that was one of Kinsey's discoveries, is that children had orgasms at a younger age than people believed. This kind of sexual latency period was not, according to Kinsey, real, and that there was all this sexual activity that children were having that we were unaware of. And so they, according to Kinsey's approach, where, you know, he's just taking them objectively as a scientist, and he's describing these actions as, you know, as related to orgasms, when the fact is you just look at these facts and you can see that the poor children are trying to get away from a rapist, you know. So you know, to describe Kinsey as a crackpot is euphemistic. I mean, he is a basically a maniac and a psychopath. And so the fact that someone who would, you know, produce this kind of data then became one of the basically the founders of the modern sex, drug, and rock and roll culture, it just shows that you know, there's malfeasance, you know, in its production from the very beginning.
Yeah, it's only stands to figure that his views or values would be diluted as they were, you know, injected into the culture, but they nevertheless would have their deleterious effects.
Sure.
And eventually it would poison the well.
Right. Well, I mean, they just repeat negative, I mean, concepts that are too absurd to even be in polite company over time can be normalized.
Well, just like today, just like I read today, there's a headline that Joe Biden presided over a wedding of two male White House staffers.
Yeah, I mean, it wouldn't surprise me at all. I mean,
just 5 years ago, that would have been ridiculous, right?
Yeah, look at how they're promoting Bruce Jenner. You know,
yeah.
I mean, they promoting him as a hero. And, you know, you see, if you look at the statistics for homosexuality that Kinsey was citing, other researchers weren't even getting one-tenth the number he was, or were getting one-tenth the number. But, you know, today I wonder, because the culture has become indoctrinal in terms of getting, you know, males to think of homosexuality as a viable sexual perspective. And then they have damaged the male's physical sexuality.
Yeah.
The sperm count of Europeans is, you know, it's catastrophically lower than it was 70, 80 years ago, perhaps as much as 50%.
Yeah, I've heard that.
And so, in addition, you have less testosterone, but you also have these estrogen mimicry chemicals. They come from plastics typically, and they give males with a much higher level of estrogen. So you've had these gender benders, toxins that have been interjected into our environment, and they are definitely affecting, you know, the production of fully formed males. And so
you also have sexual confusion, because if you have dysfunctional families, people look at the cause of sexual confusion, homosexuality. One is ambivalent or distant fathers, or, you know, fathers just aren't around. Or abuse, a trauma. And in broken families, you have much higher rates of those two things, and you're going to produce more confused or traumatized individuals that might express itself in homosexuality.
Yeah, I mean, it's just a sick, malevolent soup with, you know, dozens of components in it and dozens of ingredients that are all damaging young people, both men and women, as they grow up.
What was that play? Damaged goods that Bernays popularized?
Exactly right. I mean, it's just fascinating that way back when, at the beginning of the 20th century, when you really started to see organized malevolence, and this is beginning with this character, Edward Bernays, the father of propaganda, a weird double nephew of Sigmund Freud. You know, I won't go into the family details, but, you know, it's, you know, the, both sides of Bernays' family were related to Freud. You know, he had a very close relationship with his uncle, and of course, you know, was using the psychological science against culture. And he really brought out the what I regard as the, you know, most noticeable origin of the sex, drugs, and rock and roll culture with this his production of a play called Damaged Goods, which was had a lot of overt sexual material in it. Damaged Goods was defended by the New York Times, and who they praised the play. They called it Sex O'Clock in America. Very prescient, that comment. And then it was funded by the Rockefellers, you know, as always, and attended and supported by the Roosevelts, who were also in the audience at opening night. So, you know, when you piece all of these facts together, trying to see, well, you know, how did we get from the year 1905 to this point? Basically, you can see that culture was deformed deliberately by a collection of oligarchs and, you know, their agents. And you can really identify them pretty clearly. You know, you can actually go through from, you know, the different strands. So Bernays was one strand. In Europe, you had Gregor Lukacs, who was a Jewish individual. He was a member of the Comintern, the Communist International Party. He was given the control over culture of Hungary following World War I for a period of time. And he attempted to basically change the sexual mores of high school students, wanted to create a more free love kind of lifestyle.
This was during the regime of what, Bella Kuhn?
I'm not sure. He was in operation in 1918.
I think it would be Bella Kuhn. Yeah, the short
probably
lived.
Would, yeah. But anyway, so Lucas, I mean, he was like a modern Marxist. In other words, he was saying, basically the revolution of the proletariat doesn't look like it's going to happen, but we do really want to bring about that political control over the masses that Marx, was so desirous to bring about. And so they created what was kind of a neo-Marxism, which came out of what was called the Frankfurt School. And the Frankfurt School were just a bunch of people who wanted to transform culture. They wanted to bring about the change and the political control that Marx envisioned through what they called, or has been called, the long march through culture. They wanted to take over the institutions of the political institutions that controlled sexual laws, education particularly, they wanted to control. And then they developed what was called critical theory, which is just basically criticizing every single thing about European culture. I mean, critical theory is just another crackpot idea that has no, it just provides a veneer of, science or philosophy for someone who wants to shatter culture. And so the Frankfurt School, was founded in Europe. It was originally funded through the Comintern, but then it left Europe and came to the United States. For some reason, the American Jewish Committee that was interested after World War II in trying to develop sort of a psychological understanding of fascism and also of things that were dangerous to Jewish people. They basically hired the Frankfurt School lock, stock, and barrel. A few of them didn't participate, but a great many of them did in this thing called the authoritarian personality, which developed a lot of psychological profile technology. This was actually kind of the beginning of the science of mass marketing. They had these different psychological scales. One of them was the anti-Semitic scale, where you would take, would answer a bunch of questions and you'd get a number as to where you rated on a scale. They had a fascism scale. You'd look at it, you'd answer a bunch of questions, and then out would pop your, whether or not you were likely to become a fascist. They had an ethnocentric scale to see, well, how attached are you to your ethnicity, which evidently was a bad idea. And so that was, in my opinion, morally hard to justify, because basically what it was trying to do is to find technical means to control people without telling them. They wrote what was called the authoritarian personality, which described some of the scales and how the psychology was developed. And, just to maybe perhaps get a little bit ahead of what we'll be discussing, but the school, the Frankfurt School, and then the group that is hired by the American Jewish Committee, many of them end up related to what was called the Macy Conference, which then becomes MK Ultra, which was a secret or part of this debasement of culture. Right, MK Ultra is was now, I think there's been enough discoveries that there really isn't any way to dispute this, that MKUltra was basically looking at a way to produce the sex, drugs, and rock and roll culture that America has been damaged by. And so I did not understand the moral basis for the project. When I did research into Gordon Wasson, and you can look in articles I've written, like Manufacturing the Deadhead, you can see the pay requisitions from MKUltra you know, employing Gordon Wasson to begin the counterculture. The Life magazine article, the 1957 article, which begins the counterculture, was a CIA project. It was Subproject 58. Documentation exists. It's just clear as a bell. So, you know, you have to wonder, well, how could anyone have really the moral authority to basically damage that many human beings? Where does this organized psychosis come from? And in looking backwards in time at some of the individuals who were part of MKUltra, like Nevitt Stanford, who was at the Stanford Research Institute, and Adorno and Horkmeyer, I'm mispronouncing his name, people that were involved in the final version of what damage culture, going backwards, I found that they had been part of this American Jewish Committee project, the authoritarian personality. And then when I read their documents, I came to the conclusion, which is chapter 23 of the authoritarian personality, if your listeners want to read along, and then I found the following statement at the conclusion, and I'll just read it. It says, resistance to self-insight and resistance to social facts are contrived, most essentially of the same stuff. It is here that psychology may play its most important role. Techniques for overcoming resistance, developed mainly in the field of individual psychotherapy, can be improved and adapted for use with groups and even for use on a mass scale. Now, folks, this is fascism. I mean, this is just bold-faced fascism, because what they're saying is that they are justified in using psychological techniques against people who are not aware that they're being used and using them on a mass scale. And so then they conclude in the next paragraph, they then make this schmarmy justification, right, for what they're doing. They go, thus, we need not suppose that appeal to emotion, right? Now, that basically they're just saying being malevolent. Thus, we need not suppose that appeal to emotion belongs to those who strive in the direction of fascism, while democratic propaganda must limit itself to reason and restraint. Now, there it is, right? That they do not have to limit themselves to reason, and they aren't restrained by concern of basically of changing and damaging the minds of those that they're bringing the techniques against. I'll just read it again. Every citizen should know this sentence. It goes, thus, we need not suppose that appeal to emotion belongs to those who strive in the direction of fascism, while democratic propaganda must limit itself to reason and restraint. And then they conclude, it goes, if fear and destructiveness are the major emotional sources of fascism, Eros belongs mainly to democracy. So in other words, they're saying, look, we want the same control over the population, the same mind control that the fascists use, but we're not going to do fear and destructiveness. We're going to use Eros as democratic propaganda. And see, then MKUltra produces the sex, drugs, and rock and roll culture. And I maintain that there is a clear logical relationships between these statements and the Macy Conference, where so many of these people end up, and then on to MKUltra. And I'll just reference one of the authors of this was Nevitt Stanford, who then was actually related to to the Macy Conference, and then worked with MKUltra. He worked at the Stanford Research Institute. He produced a book which promoted psychedelic drug use. Lazarfield, who's also another one of the authors, is referenced in MKUltra documents as producing psychology that is beneficial to the program. So, I mean, it is not evidence of a kind that you can say, well, look, I want a conviction, but it is evidence, and it's strong enough. And I think, there's enough weight, in fact, that it should raise the suspicion to a really high level. And the citizens should just demand that, you know, the MKUltra project, that the science that the Macy Foundation, the Macy conferences were producing, the science that the authoritarian personality at the American Jewish Committee was advocating, that the relationships between these things need to be brought to the public. There needs to be a real public, and I mean I'm not talking about the government doing it, because that would just be, you know, letting them give themselves their own grade, but rather a process that the public could trust, that would be objective and independent, to go into the relationships between these things, because I think there's enough evidence here to everyone should be frightened at the very least, and everyone should be curious as just as a function of citizenry.
Yes. Now you've mentioned well, one thing you say, the authoritarian personality it claimed to identify the sources of fascism, which ended up being traditional Christian, patriarchal families.
It's hard not to, know, the thing is that the,
so the solution,
they bring out the scales, but it's so crackpot, and it's so malevolent, it's just so racist that
it's ethnic.
It's hard to separate the science of what they're doing from their craziness.
It's a declaration of ethnic warfare.
Yeah. I mean, it can certainly be looked at that. Yeah. And, it's a kind of it's either just an overt ethnic warfare that keeps itself hidden, or it's just a kind of arrogance that the other ethnicity is so little valued that the fact that you're spending millions of dollars developing this mental control over them is just not anything that you would even have a moral question about. It's just absolutely sick. And it really, the way that it has come into our government, and remember, MKUltra was never vetted. Helms destroyed the documents. Church committee asked for, we want every single piece of paper you've got. When they found out that they were giving LSD to citizens without the citizens knowing it, they knew they had a rogue problem inside the CIA, and they demanded the documentation. Helms destroyed it and said, I was afraid of embarrassing my friends. So that was just a bad moment for democracy. We lost at that point. But I think it just showed, who was in charge, that the democracy we think we've had and have been told we've had is in fact fake, that they've had, through the media particularly, control over the political culture. They've been able to create the candidates they want. And, we get to vote on issues like same-sex marriage and, abortion, but control over money and warfare belongs to them.
Yeah. Now, and of course, I think there was Frank Church, who died, I think, of a heart attack at the ripe old age of like 52 or 53 or something.
Yeah, so. Pity. Funny how that happens.
Funny. After looking at the heart attack gun, right? They have it on film where him and Goldwater are looking
it's
at
like, that. What was Tim Russert? Russert was the really courageous television commentator and interviewer, and he asked both Kerry and Bush Jr. What were the oaths that they took when they were members of Skull and Bones, and both of them, refused to answer. But Russert said, what does this mean for democracy? And Kerry gave him an icy glare, and he said, "Well, secrecy." He says, "I wish I could manifest something secret for you." I mean, that was a threat, and it got executed.
Yes, and he died.
I haven't seen the autopsy, but this would just be something that I would just put into my, my understanding is just obviously they got rid of someone who was a real journalist.
Now, that's how. Quite a chilling effect. But the irony is that the American Jewish Committee, in the authoritarian personality, in order to, in the name of fighting fascism, they are invoking or advocating fascist or authoritarian methods.
Exactly. Where they're saying we're going to do the exact same thing, except we're going to use sex, drugs, and rock and roll rather than fear. So, in other words, what they're saying is the way that fascism use intimidation, you know, terrorism, you know, and all of these rationales to mind control the population, we're going to do the same thing. We're not going to be limited by reason and restraint. We're just going to use a different method. We're going to use Woodstock as opposed to, you know, the storyline that the Nazis gave to the German people.
Yeah, and because that's the observation that Aldous Huxley made in Brave New World, where as you know, sexual freedom expands, political freedom contracts. Wilhelm Reich, another one of the Frankfurt School, wrote I think he wrote the fascism. What was that book he wrote on fascism?
Yeah.
But his idea was in order to change the political constitution, you had to upend the sexual constitution.
Right. I mean, this is kind of these ideas are everywhere, you know, throughout the people who are trying to influence culture. They're always trying to put into, you know, the idea out there that that sex is the real driver of culture. And the more they just get put when everyone has sex on their brain. Huxley was, you know, obviously a malevolent, you know, puppet. He was part of the oligarchy. Very close friends with the Rothschilds. In fact, there's someone who recorded, you know, Huxley's conversation at a party with the Rothschild. This was our last name was Berlin. And he said, you know, Huxley would talk about humans as though they were basically like units of, you know, numbers or something, you know. And then when you look at Brave New World, you look at it closely, you can see that, you know, in addition to all the Freemason cryptic symbolism that he has in it, it's just sickening how much of it is in there. He's really, you know, he's not expressing you know, trying to alert the population to the dangers of this coming control by the oligarchs using technology. He's actually just describing the plan, you know, and just putting it out there and normalizing it as something that everyone can experience. And in fact, you know, he's really saying that, well, this is a better way to live. You know, you can live as a delta or as a beta, and basically as a caste slave to the oligarchs. And what's good about that is that it's socially stable, you know, that it's, you're not going to have to worry about wars or anything like that. There'll just be complete control. You know, and then of course, when you see Huxley's participation in MKUltra, then it just becomes terrifying. You know, the citizen should read Brave New World and, experience rage, because what you're really looking at is the justification and the plan that they are going to implement upon European culture.
Yeah.
That's what the Brave New World is. You know, I would hope people read the paper I wrote on The Tempest, the Shakespearean play where Huxley gets the expression Brave New World. And there you can see the Shakespearean literature is this very malevolent, hard to understand, you know, kind of stuff. But I decode this in the book Shakespeare's Secret Messiah, and when you understand the framework that Huxley is using the term Brave New World from, it's, you know, you're really looking at a very, very psychopathic you know, program that we're being subjected to. And then when you look at Huxley's, you know, his connections into MKUltra, his connections into the oligarch family, the long-standing tradition that his family has with eugenics, right? So, you know, it's a way of identifying Huxley as a way of identifying his associations are all evil, basically. All of these people, you know. And then, of course, the amazing fact that Huxley and his MKUltra doctor friend Stanley Osmond, they're the ones who hired Tim Leary to become the counterculture puppet and you know, jester, court jester of the sex, drugs, and rock and roll world. I mean, they actually hired him, and there's a video. You know, it's called the, I don't know, I refer to it as the MK Ultra Union Party, but I think it's just a conversation about LSD. And it was a party in the 70s that was filmed, and they're having a few drinks, and he actually talks, Stanley Ordman talks about the day that, and Leary's right there next to him. He's actually talking to Tim Leary, and he says, you know, I remember the day that Aldous and I hired you. So, I mean, this is, you know, when you start laying the facts next to, you know, the what we know about their public life and their so-called scientific life, when you start putting now the facts that researchers have uncovered about MKUltra, about you know, Aldous Huxley, about all of the oligarchic control of all of this, you can really get a clear picture of you know, how our culture was shattered, how malevolent they are, and how really genocide is the program. I mean, they're not, you know, I mean, Huxley talks about people being reduced to deltas and, you know, betas and whatnot. Believe me, the robots will be handling all that stuff. They're definitely going to depopulate. In fact, one of the things that I would just point out, just an obvious, you know, observation is, if you notice that recently they've, the EU has immigrated millions of young Muslim men into Europe. Why are they doing this? Well, what's going to happen is they will pull the plug on the economy at some point, and then you'll have food shortages, and basically Europe will just be turned into a gladiatorial pit. And these two groups who will have been manipulated by the media into a high level of hatred for one another will simply slaughter each other.
Which is why I have these events.
Yeah.
You know, yep. Yep. And so Trump, that's, whether it's a truck or something or a shooting or,
So you're going to see these groups will be manipulated into basically a war against one another while the oligarchs sit in their, you know, their pavilion seats and cheer us on while we slaughter each other.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned, one thing is the Tempest,
and where
people put into a dream state. I can't help but think of, of course, the term the American Dream, right?
Of course, yeah. I mean, it comes right out. But the Tempest, you know, it's I don't know. I don't know how lay people can read Shakespeare, and I'm not sure what they get out of it. The plays are basically incoherent if you don't understand them. The framework that the author is generating the symbols out of, in The Tempest, the whole play is based on Isaiah, the book of Isaiah, the character Ariel, the tempest itself, the word the tempest, the dream states that the Gentiles are put into. You know, these are all basically elements right out of Isaiah 29. And then it, you know, moves into the drunkenness, which then is reflected in the play. And then it also has little things like, you know, Ariel is under the ground. And this then is reflected in the play as voice of Ariel coming from underneath the ground. And, you know, all of the symbolic level comes out of the Old Testament, and then you know, you go on to the Apocalypse, where Isaiah describes a world where basically the Gentiles have been first put into a dream and then exterminated, and this is then reflected in the play. It's done so kind of cryptically, and if you read the article, you can see my take on all this, but you know, it's pretty clear cut because, you know, like, you know, I recently had some criticism saying, well, you know, it's you're just seeing patterns that don't exist. But the problem is that I'm not. The problem is that when I show that the symbolism as you go into the later part of the play is just following the pattern of the reliance on Isaiah that is known to everyone who studies the play carefully, that is in the first part of the play, that the title and the characters are all coming right out of Isaiah. I just show that, no, it's not. It doesn't end halfway through the play. It goes all the way through. And then, of course, now you're looking at a Holocaust of the Gentiles.
Yeah, I guess.
So now when you take Aldous Huxley's use of the term,
yeah.
Huxley is very familiar with the actual real interpretive, the real correct interpretive level of Shakespeare. And he's just basically reusing the concept. And he's talking about the dream state. And it's just in here, the dream state is being manifested mechanically by psychological techniques. Whereas in Isaiah, Isaiah wasn't able to envision, I think, these devices, but, Huxley is aware of them and he's claiming that, the Brave New World is really a manifestation of this, apocalyptic prophecy that occurs in Isaiah.
Now, the dream state that Shakespeare writes of, I guess today we could interpret the dream state as consumerism, sex,
sure.
sports, and things like that.
Absolutely, yep. Absolutely.
Amusements and entertainment, things like that.
Distraction.
Yeah. And, of course, other people have written about it. I think it was Postman who wrote the book, Amusing Ourselves to Death. Was it Postman?
I'm not familiar with that.
Yeah, about that. And... these are amusements, and of course, amusements are designed to make us not think critically,
right?
Exactly. Amusements, right?
Yeah.
So, but it's interesting, yeah, that would be in there so early on. Now, of course, with your research, you've made the connection with the American Jewish Committee and the authoritarian personality. It seems that Kinsey was promoted to advance that agenda.
It's a very logical, position. I mean,
but the important thing is it predates World War II, and the justification for the authoritarian personality is the trauma and the experience of the Second World War and how the Jews suffered
during
the war.
Exactly right. I mean, that's a very important point. That if you look at the authoritarian personality, I mean, a normal human would think that the people who produce this are basically racist and crazy.
Yeah.
However, following World War II, their position had a kind of cover that was provided by the Holocaust, and that's why studying the individual Gregor Lukacs is so important, and the Frankfurt School, because they predated the Holocaust. Mm-hmm. They were developing these techniques, which then are leading to the authoritarian personality following World War I. And of course, looking at Edward Bernays and the damage that he begins to the culture in like 1910. It's very, very important.
And his uncle, Freud.
Freud, right, yeah. Yeah. The whole Tavistock, collection of individuals that are...
I think Freud said when he was introducing psychoanalysis to the United States, I am bringing them the plague.
Right. That's a quote from a person he was traveling with.
Yeah.
It's primary. In other words, the guy did make the claim, but, Freud didn't write it, in a letter or something. But the fact is, that's what was happening.
But the point is, if you analyze Freud's ideas, well, neurosis came from guilt, and guilt came from moral inhibition, particularly regarding sex. So the one way you cure your neurosis is you bring in sexual freedom. I mean, that's a black op against traditional Christians.
Exactly right. And I mean, Freud is another absolute crackpot.
Yeah.
Things like the Oedipal complex. I mean, none of this stuff has ever been replicated by any actual researcher. You have to look at people like Freud and Marx as being lifetime actors. What their role is to produce, what stands some scrutiny as, supposedly science, but is in fact just ways to politically dominate and culturally debase.
Well, no, vaccines are based on science, right?
Vaccines, yeah, right. Yeah, I'd love to take vaccines. I mean, here in California, they're trying to make it mandatory for school children. And it's just really a hard-edged fascism now. It's sad to see this happen because
They're taking off the velvet, right?
yeah, exactly. I mean, just think of it this way. I mean, like, how often has evil controlled the political landscape in our history? I mean, it just happens all the time. And the idea of giving the government the legal right to inject children with whatever they want, I mean, that's just obviously not just asking for trouble. It's demanding that at some point you'll be wiped out, because at some point, even if the current crop were not malevolent, which of course is ludicrous, at some point there will be. And then these laws will be easily used to, well, these people are too smart, and I would like my slaves to be dumber, and so I know just what vaccines to put in there. In other words, all you have to do is merge this law with evil, and you've got a population that no longer exists. So, that's
And they're
why.
using the public school system as
And they
the
use the public
vector, right?
school system, right? And then, of course, they've got the crackpot vaccine rationale, which, they're saying, well, you're endangering all of these people. Well, if the vaccines work, why don't just let them be vaccinated? Then they don't have to worry about catching it. But the fact is, they don't work. And there's a really good data set that I always, mention that people look at, and it's oh gee, it's basically where is that? Yeah, it's called Dissolving Illusions.
Oh, Susan Humphreys, yeah.
Right. And
Suzanne Humphreys.
what she's done is she's gotten the data sets for 51 diseases. And then she charts at which point the vaccine was introduced and what the results were. And you can see that virtually in no case was the trajectory of the mortality from the disease, which in all cases was heading down because you had better sanitation and a lot of other elements that were improving health, and they were the causal factors. But in no case did the vaccine change the vector. So why has vaccination become, so beloved by the oligarchs? Well, I'm afraid to say it's because they could see that eventually they'd be able to create technology where Huxley's vision could be implemented.
Was it Bertrand Russell who said that through what diet injunctions and injections will
Yeah, I've noticed that. I was calling the attention of all of these survivor shows over the last few years. You
Yeah.
see these survivor shows, and they're just normalizing a post-electric world where the European is, naked and afraid. They have a show; it's actually called "Naked and Afraid," where people who don't know each other, right, a man and woman, are forced to live without anything, and they just set out into the wilderness with no clothes on. And what this does is just normalizes the attributes of the post-electric world, so that we can then walk into our future without complaining. But recently, I've noticed that they're trying to normalize autism. They have these shows coming out now where they have basically, I'll use the word retarded, children and people. And they're trying to normalize them. They're trying to, show them as heroic, and I'm sure that this is just they're getting basically the epsilon and delta class normalized, because if you look at our diet and the vaccinations that they have in mind, we're going to be producing children with very limited intellectual powers in the future, and they want that class to exist as slaves and menial workers, and so they're normalizing it with these shows. And I think you're going to see more and more, basically, it's hard to find words that are both polite but at the same time accurate. But you've got the transvestites, Miley Cyrus, and now the autistic children. I mean, that's really, where we are being taken, right? That's these are the inhabitants of the brave new world.
And no one's questioning the skyrocketing rates of autism.
And exactly. Is that, well, they try, but because the media is controlled, they don't get anywhere. I was at a public meeting a couple months ago. I live in Santa Barbara. I was astounded at this meeting, how many people, it was about the relationship between diet and vaccinations and health. And I was astounded at the number of parents that came forward and gave testimony about vaccine damage and of the anger. And, you know, I'm hoping that, you know, as the internet develops, that more information can spread out and there can be some resistance because, you know, we're at the point where we really are just really, you know, hanging by a thread. And what I'm so afraid of is that, you know, they're going to pull the plug on the financial system. And then at that point, you know, you have the potential for real population reduction. Mm-hmm.
That's right. It's set to be fragile, so they can crash it when they want and buy everything up on pennies on the dollar. That's
whatever's left. Yeah.
So, I mean, what's interesting about your research is the connection between one thing being Alfred Kinsey, the sexual revolution, and of course the Rockefellers, but the connection that it made to the American Jewish Committee. And the role, the organized Jewish community, or at least Jewish elite.
Well, yeah, you've got all these connections between that are inside the Frankfurt School that end up in the counterculture, in intelligence. I mean, I'll just give you an example, like Herbert Marcuse. Mm-hmm. He is in the Frankfurt School. He doesn't become part of the American Jewish Committee, but he becomes part of the OSS, right? Then he becomes, you know, he's linked into the Macy conferences and then on to his work, Eros and Civilization. And if you go through the Frankfurt School and then try to just calibrate it, you know, as it goes through time as to where the people end up, you're seeing a lot of them end up inside of these different organizations that are involved in the production of the counterculture. It's not a straight line. It's not like, well, they become the Macy and then it becomes MKUltra. And you know, it's like, you know, we're limited by the reference. In other words, you know, you have the word MKUltra, but the fact that MKUltra exists proves that there is an organization beyond MKUltra. You know, somehow MKUltra wasn't a rogue organization that, you know, just broke loose and decided to damage American culture. So obviously the words MKUltra, the Macy Conference, you know, they're just part of this larger organization, larger project. And this is really how they should be studied, is you know, how they fit in to the larger project, because obviously Freemasonry is involved in this. And so, but many people in Freemasonry are not part of this project. So and many people in the CIA, you know, are not part of the project. So you have the ability to somehow control the effect of the organization. In other words, you can control the projects, right? But not everybody needs to be basically a member of the controlling group. If you look at the Grateful Dead, you know, the band is just a cesspool of secret societies. You've got, you know, the Freemasons, Bohemian Grove, MKUltra, the CIA, you have St. Elizabeth Hospital. You have all of these different, you know, aspects of the project are being represented, you know, inside the different band members. But they're not all part of MKUltra. They weren't all hired by MKUltra like Robert Hunter was. They weren't all Freemasons like Lesch was. And then, you know, they aren't all Bohemian Grove members. I mean, I get the secret societies confused. There's so many of them. but the fact is that the band was, you know, this cesspool of secret societies, but it wasn't just one. It was a whole bunch of them. So, you know, we shouldn't be confused by the words. You know, we got to keep our eye on the project itself, on how all of these different things fit together, on how they are controlled, And because the actual organization is hidden from us, you know, we don't know about it. It is hidden.
Well, it is. It's operating on the Freemasonic principles of rings.
For sure. I mean, certainly Freemasonry was one of the identities it had. I don't think it ever was the only one. But of course, then it's just replacing one mystery with another. I mean, who are the Freemasons? You know, who are the top level? Why are they held together? How can they come through the ages like this? And I think that, you know, the best explanation is, you know, is that there are the Tectons, which was a group that was satirized in the Gospels. The word, again, it's the confusion of words. In the Gospels, they translate Tecton as a carpenter. They say Jesus was a carpenter, or wasn't he? They ask the question, and they say his father was. And Josephus then talks about the Tectons. But in this instance, the word is used as Masons, right? In fact, in Greece today, modern Greek, Tecton simply means Freemason. Okay, so that's the word has come through history. And so there was a group in the first century that had a relationship into building and architecture. In the Dead Sea Scrolls, I think it sometimes is reflected. They call themselves the Builders. They have all this Masonic imagery, you know, make straight a path for the Lord, you know, be the plumb line of God. You know, all these Masonic images are represented in them. Josephus talks about the Tectons. In the Gospels, the Tectons are seen as a guild. In my opinion, you know, there's some semantical skirmishes about this, but that's my opinion. Now you go forward and you have the Knights Templar, focused on the Temple of Jerusalem, mysterious group, a secret society, very early. They run afoul of the Vatican, Holy Roman Empire. They disappear or become nascent for a while. You know, they go out. No one really knows about them. But then you have the Freemasons pop up. And again, you've got this focus on the Temple of Jerusalem, you know, the Hiram Abiff story where, you know, he's the builder of the temple. And, you know, all the initiations or many of the initiations we know about have Hiram as, the centerpiece of it. So, you know, there's a kind of fuzzy line, you know, it leads from this early guild, the Tectons, through the Templars into the Freemasons. And then once the Freemasons get going, I mean, look at their, how many U.S. presidents are Masons. Mm-hmm. Look at the fact that you have Skull and Bones as, in my opinion, an obvious adjunct of Freemasonry, and like I think three of our presidents who supposedly weren't Freemasons were Skull and Bones members, right? So you have all of this cesspool, you know, of secret society that we don't really understand or know much about, but it's embedded inside our world. You know, Benjamin Franklin, of course, is just a Freemason, and then he's also a member of this weird Hellfire Club. And then they also find, I think, 11 bodies buried in the basement of the house he lived in Philadelphia. And I mean, you know, you get these crumbs and little points of data, but it just over time and with enough research, you can see that actually, you know, there is certainly enough to for the public to start to move to understand the secret society. And the thing that I always say, Tim, is that get DNA evidence, you know. Get the evidence, get the DNAs of like the Rockefellers, the Rothschilds, Lyndon Baines Johnson, his family. It'd be easy to identify, you know, the media oligarchs, right? Find out if they're related, because anyone can claim to be anything. You know, they can claim an ethnicity. Let's see what the DNA data gives us. You know, I have been advocating this for some time, and I gave the as a person I'd like to see analyzed Madonna, culture polluting quasi horror Babylon type, you know.
Yeah.
And then I read a few months later that she had hired a DNA cleanup crew. I'm not making this up. She actually has a DNA cleanup crew that goes after her whenever she tours now. And I don't know if it's related to, you know, my request, but it wouldn't surprise me if a lot of the oligarchs are going to be possessing DNA cleanup crews in the future. Because I think the thing is, this is something the citizens can do, actually. We don't have to guess or sit here and complain about being impotent. I mean, there are lots of people who are related to the oligarchs that I think would be willing to let us have DNA samples. And then this data could be posted, experts could collate it, you know, you'd be able to start making sense out of it, see who's related to who, you know, where, you know, and you know, it could be a null set. I have people that say, oh, you won't find anything, you know, it's money and greed that holds these people together. Well, prove it, you know, let's get Hillary Clinton's DNA and compare it to the Rothschilds, compare it to LBJ and the Rockefellers and the Morgan family, the Roosevelts. There are members of these families that are in existence that are certainly, you know, I think would be willing to let us have a cotton swab. And then we could actually make some progress as to who the people are that have, you know, taken control of the financial, political, and media that generates our culture and have led to such a holocaust for Europeans, right? I mean, if you look at the 20th century with the physical holocaust, and now you look at the 21st century with the chemical holocaust, with the, you know, with the food, with the glyphosate, the Roundup, you know, with the vaccines, with all of the plastic in the environment. I mean, you know, and then of course with all of the different ways to shatter family. I mean, you know, it begs a question, Tim, and yep. The question should be answered right now.
Yes. Now, yeah, you mentioned, of course, you mentioned the combines. I think that's kind of what we're dealing with. I think we're dealing with a cabal of criminal syndicates.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at Ken Kesey, who is part of the deal, obviously, I mean, he's just analytically a lead pipe cinches to have been part of the organization. In his book, Cuckoo's Nest, he gives actually what I think is the very first description of the organization. He calls it the Combine. It's this, you know, spider web, he calls it, that spreads over the entire world. And, you know, it controls things through wires. And, you know, he has actually fairly vivid but metaphorical depiction of the thing. The term that he uses, I think, comes from the description of the trading companies in the 18th century, East-West trading companies. These were, these trading companies really were the most powerful economic force in the world. They were completely Freemasonic and Jewish. You know, the Rothschilds were in there. They developed a relationship, you know, the American trading companies and the European trading companies were organized. And that was called the Combine. And I think that's where Kesey, you know, gets the term. Just, you know, you mentioned something like Adam Smith. You know, he was a propagandist for the company. He wrote Wealth of Nations, which is, you know, often given as an example of why capitalism and free markets are a good idea, when in fact, you know, it was just a piece of propaganda that the trading company needed to be created because they were getting flack for selling opium and human slaves.
Yeah, right? And also the sort of this cult of optimal production.
Yeah. We have you have the Optomicon. Yeah. There was two propagandists. One was Shelburne. Yeah, maybe Shelburne was his name. But he worked with Smith, and Shelburne developed, you know, the Panopticon, which was just a gearbox for poor people, like a big giant slave ship, and you know that they turned gears. You know, it's just crazy fascism. But he also wrote, you know, In Defense of Pederasty. You know, he was one of the early, you know, advocates of you know, sex with children.
Was this Bentham?
Yeah, Bentham. I'm sorry. Bentham. Exactly right. It was Bentham. Yeah, it was Shelburne was the one who ordered the propaganda to be created. Yeah, it was Bentham.
Yeah.
And so Bentham came up with this cockamamie stuff, and he worked with Smith. And Smith's, you know, The Wealth of Nations is still just sickeningly being brought out as, you know, well, this is rationale for free markets, which is nothing but an excuse for the oligarchs to have monopolies, right? I mean, anyone who believes in free markets, you wouldn't have something like the Federal Reserve, which can create credit out of thin air, right? And then it can give its tribe members the credit, right, at 0.25%, where your credit card gets charged 8%.
Right? Yeah, and they make a killing off the carry trade.
Yeah, of course. So yeah, and then they have basically it's just a, you know, legalized theft, and yet it's being defended as, well, you know, it's private sector. You know, it's we need a separation with to government. So it's just sophistry. They just have got some clever arguments to defend, you know, the attributes of slavery. But no one should be fooled. It's just we need to think better to defend ourselves intellectually better, because they know how to use these sophist arguments to spin our mind and to confuse us, and we don't recognize who the real villain is.
And of course, in the surplus labor that they Bentham proposed man these gearboxes. Was created by the enclosure movement and the destruction of the monastic system in England, which provided.
And actually, he went on. He actually described that, you know, some of the people moving the gears would be the children of the indigent. Yeah. In other words, if you're poor, because our policies have shattered the economy, and you're a kid of someone who doesn't have any money, well, here's where you end up. That's you're basically a human, you know, rat, and your crime was being a kid of someone who didn't have any money. These are the people that are promoting the Wealth of Nations and all of this cockamamie idea about the value of free markets. Look, we haven't seen a free market in hundreds and hundreds of years. How would anyone know what it is? how it functions? We're in the gearbox. We're in the panopticon. And
an example of that today would be the privatized, like the American Correctional Corporation, where I think in their prospectus they call for like a 92% rate in prison. 92 of the beds have to be filled in order for their contracts to be profitable, and it's in their prospectus. Of course, one way you fill those beds is you pass laws that make sure that enough people go into prison, and that's one of the functions of the
prison. Prison is just part of population reduction.
Yep.
You know, the culture is a cesspool. It has been, you know, basically created as a, you know, kind of a applied weaponized anthropology. The media is under tight control, and so it supports the dream world where people are told they're free and that we should be patriotic. I mean, the saddest thing you can see is, like, you know, when someone is killed in Afghanistan, you know, and then they bring the body back and, you know, some muckamuck talks about the, you know, how he's defending freedom, and you know, they have the flag and the flyover of the planes, and the family is basically in a dream world, you know, where they don't understand that, you know, there was an agenda back of the war, that their son or daughter was used as fodder for a very, very evil plan, and then they're given patriotism as the rationale so that they don't even rebel against the system that is basically murdered one of their family members. You know, it's just absolutely tragic. I mean, notice that as the wars have gone on, the flags that they use at the halftime of football games in the NFL are just bigger and bigger.
Yeah, they don't fit in the stadium anymore.
They hardly fit in the stadium, yeah. And it's just, you know, this is just mind control to keep people to look at propaganda rather than to think about malevolence, you know.
Yeah, this reminds me of we're talking about the Combine and what's really going on, is the 1976 movie Network.
Yeah.
With Ned Beatty, I think his character is Arthur Jensen. He's talking to Howard Beale. And Howard Beale's, you know, has this populist TV show that's become a big hit. And so the network, you know, promotes the show because they want the ratings. All of a sudden, he puts the kibosh in some big deal because he's talking about how, you know, some sort of trade deal or something. And so all of a sudden this popular media figure screws up this big deal. So Ned Beatty, who's the, I guess the head honcho there, invites him into this big boardroom.
Well, yeah, they have that scene where he's
it's a great scene. And he goes, "You have meddled with the forces of nature, Mr. Beale, and I won't have it. Is that clear?" And he goes, "The Arabs have taken out billions of dollars, and they must put it back. It's ecological balance. It's tidal gravity." He says, but this is a great scene where he says, he just gets to explain how most people see the world. And
That's right. That scene is just fantastic. Yeah. I mean, it's in your face. They love to do that.
He goes, "You are an old man who thinks in terms of nations and peoples. There are no nations. There are no peoples. There are no Russians. There are no Arabs. There are no third worlds. There is no West. There's only one holistic system of systems, one vast, immane, interwoven, interacting, multivariate, multinational dominion of dollars, petrodollars, electrodollars, multidollars, Reichmarks, Rins, rubles, pounds, and shekels. It is the international system of currency which determines the totality of life in this planet. This is the special order of things. This is the atomic and subatomic and galactic structure of things today."
There is no America. There is no democracy. Right in their face, you know, and it's just they want to not only control us, but to basically represent their victory. You know, they like legacy. They like, mocking the people that they're controlling, their stupidity. And so they put out the truth in a, you know, thinly veiled symbolic level, but it's right there in front of you. And it's just, there's a film called My Dinner with Andre. The one guy says, you know, he says, "It's incredible. The people of New York are building a slave system for themselves and they don't even know it." I don't have the quote here, but that's what he, you know, and it's just very clear that that's just a statement that they put out as a legacy piece. It's like Brave New World in a way, which is.
Yeah, this is the interesting part in that network part. He says, he closes out, he goes, "We no longer live in a world of nations and ideologies, Mr. Beale. The world is a college of corporations, inexorably determined by the immutable bylaws of business. The world is a business, Mr. Beale. It has been since man crawled out of the slime. And all children will live, Mr. Beale, to see the perfect world in which there's no war or famine, oppression or brutality. One vast ecumenical holding company for whom all men will work to serve a common profit, in which all men will hold a share of stock, all necessities provided, all anxieties tranquilized, all boredom amused."
Brave New World.
That's Brave New World, yeah.
Yeah. Well, Tim, I think we put a pretty good face on it. Yeah. I've got some things I got to take care of, but man, it's been great talking to you, brother, and hope we can do it again.
Oh, certainly. Thank you for coming on again.
My pleasure.
Your new book, when's that due out?
It's hit a snag because the author is just not quick-witted enough to get it done correctly. I'm struggling with just getting it right, but I'm hoping to have it out in about 60 days.
Oh, cool. Okay. So
I'll send you a copy. Secret Language of the Oligarchs. I do the modern typology. Brave New World is one of the centerpieces of it. And I do some Beatles show with how the vicious Freemason imagery works in the Beatles songs and stuff. And it's a laugh riot. A page turner. So we'll see what happens.
Great. Look forward to that.
Okay. Well, cool. Well, I'll give you a hoot as soon as I get it ready, and I'd love to get some feedback from you.
Great. Thank you. And that's Joe Atwell. His website is postleviana.com.
Yeah. And caesarsmessiah.com.
Okay.
I have two websites. One does like ancient stuff and one does modern stuff. Post Flaviana, the post Flavians is, as you can see, like there's articles there which are about, you know, modern typology, modern, literature pieces that are part of the oligarchs, representation of what's happening to us. And then at caesarsmessiah.com, you can buy the books at either place. And thanks for letting me on. Come on, Tim. I'll talk to you soon.
Great. Thank you. And good night.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.